Crackheads, it's Friday. That can only mean one thing. It is the crack. I am Petey Carroll. And we missed you last week. You know, it was that big holiday y'all do over there. Giving thanks. I hope you all had a wonderful time doing exactly that. I didn't see enough images of the dinners. You know, I like to see a hefty dinner for Thanksgiving. I did not see a lot of that, unfortunately. Hopefully you can bounce back next year with more pictures of your beautiful meals. But it is the last ever, potentially, UFC pay-per-view this weekend. And we're lamenting this. I mean, it's a great card for the diehards especially. May not be the one to provoke much casual interest, but it is two of the best pound-for-pound fighters in the world. Merab Dvalishvili and Alexandre Pantoja defending their titles. Well, looking to defend their titles in a very, very nice card. Here they are hitting the scales. There's the boy Merab. Cardio to die for. He talked to Chuck Mendenhall this weekend. And there is Piotr Jan. He's in good shape too, of course. There's Pantoja. What a guy. Looking good. And there's the young gun, Joshua Van. Full of youth and enthusiasm. But will that be enough? I did say that Chuck spoke to Merab at the weekend. I don't know if it was at the weekend, to be honest. He definitely spoke to him, though. And what a year it's been for him. Started off the year very upset, as Chuck's great piece points out. He was having that fight with Nurmagomedov. Didn't really feel like he was the one the promotion were pushing forward. And now we get to the end of the year, and he is clearly the fighter of the year if he gets this thing done. Four title defenses in a year, never been done before. We had Poatan going for three last year, Usman going for three in 2021, and many others. And we'll talk about all of this today. But I am delighted that the aforementioned Chuck Mendenhall and the brilliant Ben Folks are here today. Lads, how are you? Are we feeling festive? Look at those faces full of thanks. You know what I mean? It's just.
Is there an Irish Thanksgiving? What do you guys do? What's going on?
We're not very thankful people.
No.
We have a resentment week, you know? We shake our fists.
Week. It's not a day.
You
it's a week.
Motherfuckers. We just point ourselves towards Great Britain and go, "Duh!" For a week. What are you joking?
The thing you got to learn about the way we approach, though, Thanksgiving in America is, as soon as it's over, we don't talk about it. You're bringing it up now, and it feels like it happened 6 months ago to us. We switch immediately into Christmas mode. You know, the day after, my kids have started on a little whiteboard I have on the refrigerator. They started the countdown to Christmas.
So true.
Immediately after, we move on from that gratitude shit with a quickness and go right to, when do the presents show up? That's America.
Hobby Lobby goes right after Halloween into Christmas. You know what I'm talking about? There's no Thanksgiving.
See, this is the thing. I told you guys, we're planning to get the Christmas tree this weekend. Me and my kids are going to get it, put it up, and decorate it and everything. An event that they both look forward to and dread, because they know that if I'm putting up the Christmas tree and we're decorating that thing, we're listening to the Bob Dylan Christmas album.
That's a good compromise.
That is what is happening, and they're going to have to deal with it. And to them, like some of these Christmas songs, to them, the only version they know is a haggard 70-year-old Bob Dylan crooning his way through them.
This is a pretty recent album, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, it's the last 20 years. Right?
Yeah, it came out like 20 years ago. I don't know about recent, but like, yeah, 20 years ago, probably.
I'm not sure I've ever heard it.
Oh my God. He had one single off, I believe it was Frosty the Snowman, and it will scar you for life if you listen to it. It will be embedded into your mind for the rest of your life, my friend. Lads, big old weekend here. Final pay-per-view. And Chuck, you have an article coming out about this, and we do have a whole section dedicated to this, which is meant to be later on the show, but I'm moved to ask you straight off the bat. There's a lot of lamentations coming from Connecticut. I mean, a lot of people rejoicing in the fact that the pay-per-view era is over, but you've made some great points in this article that's coming out today and in an article you put out last week. But give us a brief rundown of some of your concerns with this new era that is upon us.
I don't know if it's exactly lamentations. Like, I think that all of us would be like, it's better if we don't have to figure out the illegal streams, or I mean, buy the pay-per-views, you know what I mean? Like, if we don't have to pay those prices, that's probably better. My concern, okay, so I'm in the most nostalgic sense, these were always the markers, right? These numbered cards, these pay-per-views that the community kind of pulled together. It actually sort of excluded a certain part of the population, the casuals who would not spring for it. So like it became this more of its exclusive thing. And for the longest time, especially when social media was first a thing before it became the cesspool that it is now. But like when it first was out, it was like this community would come together and we'd all be commenting and high-fiving, you know, digitally across. And you'd be like, this is an amazing experience. And to see it as it's happening was a big deal. And that was kind of a roll off from the old boxing, you know, shows from the Tyson days and all that stuff. So I think that there's just a little bit of a pang, you know, of like saying like, man, I'll miss those days. And they're long gone anyway, right? Like those days are long gone. It's just now they take the price tag off it. That's a good thing. My bigger concern now is that you enter this kind of gray horizon where there's 46, whatever they're going to do amount of cards. There's just constant activity. There's no off season. And you just basically now there's no distinguishing between what is what. Now, I'm sure that they're still going to stack and have premier cards, but they're going to probably, you know, put, they're going to disperse talent in different ways. We don't know what that looks like yet. And my biggest concern is that it just loses its kind of passion hold on the, what the diehards have had. And I think that that's kind of what I'm looking at. You know, it was just, there was always this kind of valuable something to it. It was a pain in the ass to pay for it. Nobody wanted to do that, but there was something about it that brought everybody together and kind of kept the ship, you know, moving forward. And I don't know what it looks like in the new era when you don't have something like these flagships. I'm sure they're going to try to keep that going, but I think that there's a fear that it will kind of drone on without the offseason, all that. It will just kind of drone on where you don't really distinguish cards as much anymore.
Ben, you wrote about this, the initial bookings we've got for 2026. And the reason I asked you about this is because Chuck has highlighted this in his article last week and the one that's going to come out today, I believe. The idea that we have this fleeting sense of meritocracy in the sport right now. And the announcements, I believe, kind of sent this kind of, really sent it home for a lot of people. Like, well, are we going to be saying goodbye to the idea that the definite number one guy is fighting for a title in this new era?
Yeah, these initial announcements, I think maybe we put a little bit undue weight on them just because we know we're headed into the Paramount era. We're wondering what that's going to look like, how it's going to be different, you know, when we get rid of the pay-per-views, all that stuff. And so when you make these first few announcements and you make them at halftime of a Thanksgiving Day Dallas Cowboys game, which, you know, is a pretty good opportunity for you to get share of the spotlight, especially for that game. That does feel like the game where people just turn it on and leave it on. You know, they're not channel surfing during the halftime show. So like, it's a good opportunity for the UFC to reach some of these new people. You see them rolling out these ads where they're taking advantage of Paramount knowing a thing or two about the movie business and trying to make these parallels, saying like the UFC, this is cinema. And we're going, okay, so we are moving into some sort of a new age. But then you look at the matchups you make and you go, is that new age good though? Because it does seem like some perplexing choices, especially the decision to do Alexander Volkanovski and Diego Lopez again, you know, when that was Volkanovski's last title fight was that one. The other one at the interim lightweight belt where we do with Justin Gaethje and Paddy Pimblett, just skipping over the number one contender, Armin Sarukian. And it kind of makes you go, why are we having these fights? Why are we bothering to rank people? Why are we doing any of this at all if we're basically just choosing people and being like, that guy's kind of popular, this guy's kind of popular, let's have him fight for a belt that we grabbed out of the supply closet. So I think that there is a lot of sort of angst right now with people looking ahead to what that's going to be like. I think it will, like Chuck brings up a good point about how the thing that kind of makes the pay-per-views feel special and feel big, partly it's that the UFC treats them as these are a separate thing, and that's why you got to pay for them. They have bigger fights. They have like better, more anticipated fights. That's why you got to plunk down a credit card or at least go to the trouble to find in one of those illegal online streams that I hear exist. Remember when it used to be a
they
big
do,
topic?
Ben, of they do. I've seen it.
Remember it used to be a thing all the time where we would wait to hear the numbers about pay-per-view buys.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And basically just the entire industry relying on Dave Meltzer to give us a right. reliable number. And that has even stopped being a thing. But that used to be the way we judged these things afterwards to see how successful it was. It used to be how we told who was really a star and who just seemed True. Like maybe they could be a star at some point. You'd look at some of those numbers coming out of Conor McGregor fights or Ronda Rousey fights or Brock Lesnar fights, and you'd be like, look at the huge pay-per-view numbers this person is drawing. And you're kind of losing all of that. I'm not complaining about it because this is the first time in my life as a MMA fan where it seems like the price is actually going to go down, at least for the short term.
Like,
yeah, we'll see. We'll see. Okay. You know, at some point, I've been saying this for a while, at some point, they're gonna try the pay-per-view waters via Paramount.
Yeah.
They're going to just see if people will go for it. And I'm saying this to you now.
Too.
Everyone out there who can hear the sound of my voice, this is our opportunity. Shut it down. They're going to do it at some point. Don't fall for it.
The Zone would never have tried anything like that. So no. I don't say.
If you just hold off the first time they do it and you just go, nope, we put that behind us. We're not doing it anymore. They'll give up.
I know.
They'll give up.
I thought I was having a stroke, man. Every DAZN card that comes along, I'm like, did they not? Like, I'm there paying like $25,000 for all these shit cards. I'm like,
Vin brings up a good point, though. Like, you know, we used to look at those numbers. They used to mean so much to the growth of the sport, too. Like, we'd look at them as a weather vane, almost like, dude, that one topped 700,000 buys. And you'd be like, that's crazy, you know? And then the whole Dana White back in the day, if we get 1 million buys, I'll jump off the Mandalay Bay. I point this out all the time. He never did uphold that promise. But it was such an indicative thing, right, of the sport moving forward in this big way that we were involved in, too, because we were writing about it. It was part of our livelihoods to see it succeed. And that's another one of those weird things, right? Like, you're like, man, these things meant a lot on a lot of levels. And it was also, like Ben was pointing out, it kind of moored the UFC, to be honest, and its matchmaking a little bit. You're talking about what's happening the first of 2026. If you're paying the price, like, I think the intention was always, yes, we have to put the fights on that people want to see, because on a pay-per-view model, that's who's buying the fights, right? Like, you're going to have those people are going to be paying. And I think there was a time when the meritocracy had to stand, you know, to an extent, because that's what people wanted to see. There were occasions where and everybody kind of knew this, they'd go along with it, or a guy came along who might trump the other dude in some weird way, and you're like, okay, I can see why they'd give him the title shot. But it wasn't as egregious as kind of just, all right, Diego Lopez, you're right back in there. You know, this seems almost already completely off brand from what the UFC has stood for a long, long, long time.
Yeah, it's a great point. And there is that sense of nostalgia. It's almost like, as we're talking about it, and I know we kind of talked about it during the roundtable this week as well, when you're bringing up all these old school pay-per-view names and everything, it kind of sends the head back to those times. But I also just think about, like, when I was pay-per-views, those early pay-per-views, I was a kid then, and I had all my friends over, and we're underage drinking, watching this stuff, having the time of our lives, watching the sport nobody in Ireland really knew about, right? Like, this is before McGregor is there. Like, this is, like, my brother is essentially telling us, like, watch this guy, he's really good. And we're like, oh shit, this is crazy. Like, we all have our different fighters, our favorites. They might not even, you might see them fight once a year, you know?
Did you go to UFC 93?
Yeah, I went to that one, yeah.
That was like big deal.
There's such thing as underage drinking in Ireland?
Yeah. I mean, listen.
You know what? There's overage drinking out there too, Ben. They've got all of it.
I thought you just had to be old enough to order. That's some pubs, this is news. But you do raise a good point. This for years has been how I've gauged the mainstream interest in UFC pay-per-views is, does anybody I know who is kind of an MMA fan hit me up wanting to come over and watch? And that's
the phone call gauge. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Especially because it's like they know, you know, hey, I'm getting it regardless. I can expense it, all that kind of stuff. You know, it's a tax write-off for me. And so they'll just go like, and you know, the last pay-per-view hit that mark where several of my friends who were just like, they watch it, they'll watch two or three cards a year, you know? Or like when I was doing a lot of jiu-jitsu and like guys from, you know, you'd go to jiu-jitsu open mat on Saturday morning and people would be like, so,
you tonight. Watching today?
Yeah, you know?
And we get
like,
together?
That's kind
of
how
you
tell. And
then have another open mat while the fights are on, of course.
Not getting a lot of calls for the Marab fight, huh?
No, and see, that was a good like kind of gauge. Now it seems like Paramount's got to pick up a lot of subscribers from this in order to make it even close to a good idea to pay the UFC the exorbitant amount of money that they're paying to get this stuff. And so you got to think that they have a vested interest in me. Like, you got to make these kind of fights that people can't stand to miss, and that people will, you got to make enough of them often enough that people will kind of set and forget the subscription, that they will sign up and then they will just stick around. We don't want them, you know, bouncing in just because they see we have a good one. Like, that's not going to really work for their model. They need to have like a huge influx of subscribers. And maybe that's what we're thinking here, is we're going, Patty Pimblett and Justin Gaethje, get some people in the door to start the year. That is exactly what we need. And once they're in, then it's a lot easier to keep them. I don't know, but it is like, it's going to be interesting to see how much say they get, and or how they're able to lean on the UFC for some of this. Because that is something we heard toward the end of this ESPN deal, that the UFC was unhappy with how quickly ESPN raised prices. ESPN was kind of unhappy with the UFC seeming at times like it wasn't trying all that hard. And we've honestly, especially, you know, we've been around long enough in the sport to have seen the UFC go through a few different broadcast partners. And there's a trend so far. Everybody starts off very enthusiastic. Everybody is best friends. Yeah. They're going straight to the moon with this deal. By the end, everybody's glad to see one another go. So it'll be interesting to see how this one plays out.
It is crazy, this talk of meritocracy. And we have a whole section on this later on. But like, we're kind of going, well, there's better fights out there. I think most people would agree in terms of meritocracy. And meanwhile, they're moving into the boxing space being like, they're not doing this right. Like, you know, they're not making the fights. You know, everybody wants to see them. We're like, well, we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, that is funny. That's good timing by them, right?
Yeah, it's crazy. But let's talk about this card coming up. Chuck, I mentioned this piece you did with Merab, and it's crazy how the year started and how it ended. What was it like revisiting? Because these two separate times you spoke to him frame probably one of the greatest years any champion has had in the organization.
Well, it's funny because I went out there, I think it was January 3rd is when I visited him at his gym at Syndicate in Vegas. And I was expecting, to be honest, because every time I talked to him in the past, he's a very like kind of cordial, merry guy. Like, he's like, hey, buddy, you know, that sort of thing. But this particular time, and, you know, I didn't know about the staph infection and things like that at the time. He was keeping that concealed. He was very pissed off, though. And the piece ended up being called something like that, like Merab Dvalishvili is pissed off. You know, it was something along those lines. But he just was so mad at the way things were going. He was very reluctant to be fighting on that card. He was missing all of the holidays that we celebrate. The Georgian holidays were just about to go off as the fight was happening, like January 19th. He was fighting on the 18th. And he was just not in a good mood. And so, like, if you've talked to him before, if you ask him a single question, he'll sometimes rant for 10 minutes, 15 minutes. You're like, I have no idea how I'm going to cut that up into any kind of bite-sized, like, quote to use. But he did that several times. And it was always geared toward, you know, just kind of feeling disrespected by his opponent, a little bit by the UFC, although he didn't really admit that. But just the fact that, you know, we were respecting Umar's Ramadan. Like, I'm not fighting in Ramadan. Meanwhile, he's missing everything that's going on in his life to make this fight happen. So I was like, I should bookend this by talking to him, because now here he is. He's going for a record fourth defense, which seems highly unlikely if you go back to that first conversation. He was able to navigate all of that win. He later revealed, like, obviously he was at the staff, all the things that were going on. And be as dominant as he is. And this time, I wasn't sure what to expect when I brought that up, but now he kind of laughs about it. And it was kind of like a feel-good movie in the end, because he's like, oh, we all survived, and now I'm going for the record. Isn't this all great? I love fighting. You know, that sort of thing. So it was kind of fun to do this, knowing that you talked to him at the very beginning, and he's here now. But, dude, he's in a good space. It looked like his weight cut was on point, and he's got a great chance now of doing what he set out to do.
The weight cut is one thing I admit I wondered about, because making that weight four times in a year, is the kind of thing that could catch up with you. You know, normally we've seen guys go through this before where they have a really busy year. Remember when Donald Cerrone, like, I think it was maybe his first year in the UFC, had coming over from the WEC, and I think he fought five times that year.
Five times he did, yep.
And he lost to Nate Diaz at the end of the year. And
that's right.
The audio we heard from his corner, from the Jackson Winklejohn corner, is them being like, he's flat. He's just fought too much this year, you know, and it's catching up to him. And it's like, that can happen. Of all the people it seems least likely to happen to, Merab is probably at the top of that list, you know.
He might not want to spar five rounds before this one, though, you know, on the day of. I mean, that's just something he could avoid.
I mean, if you told me that he's still going to go out there, fight like Merab for five full rounds, show up at the after party, spin kicking in jeans, I'll believe you, you know, like doing some Chuck Norris action jeans shit.
That was fucking crazy. That was fucking crazy.
One of the things I really like, I wrote about this a little bit this week, one of the things I really like about him going for this record is how it seems to fit so perfectly with what we know of him as a person and as a fighter. He's the guy who just can never sit still. He's always moving. He's always going. And it feels fitting that, like, yeah, of course this guy who fights like a damn wind-up toy where you just have to point him in the right direction and there he goes. Of course he's going to be the guy to set the record for the most titled fights in a year. Of course he's going to be the guy who just is doing this nonstop, because that is very much what we see of him in between the bells inside the cage. So, like, of course he's going to book his time as champion that way. It just makes sense. I do, though, still wonder, like, especially at his age, you know, getting up there a little bit into the 30s, making that weight over and over and over again, it could always surprise you. Your body might show up not feeling its best. Maybe Merab could still get it done that way, though, you know, especially in this fight. I think he has all the advantages.
I don't think he ever intended to do this. Like, he kind of now points out, like, yeah, I wanted to fight four times. I'm not sure that you actually look at a calendar year, at least the first time through. But what was interesting in this conversation I just had with him is I was like, so what about, how would you even have an encore? Like, obviously you're going to want time. And he's like, you know, I'd like to fight in March and then June and then two more time after that, you know. And I'm like, so you want to fight four more times? And that's where I'm like, okay, that seems kind of unrealistic to me.
Yeah, it's a huge feat. And am I crazy to think that we made a bigger deal out of Poatan's last year, kind of matching that three? Because we've had three quite a few times. We had, I have it here in front of me, we have Frank Shamrock in 1998, Tito Ortiz 2001, Chuck Liddell 2006, Demetrius Johnson 2013, Matt Hughes 2002, Usman 21, and then of course Poatan.
Usman's always stood out. Like, that always felt to me like a big one. But I mean, the Poatan one, you guys tell me what you think. I mean, to me, it was more the escalation of the moment, because it was UFC 300, right, was the first one that he did that year. And because the UFC needed something big and he could fit that role, it felt so big because he jumped in, he does it. Remember, the follow-up was UFC 303, it's supposed to be Conor McGregor, it doesn't end up being with a broken toe. He shows up with a toe of his own that's mangled or whatever, and like, he still does it. And I felt like that the escalation of those types of events where he's stepping in the biggest possible lights, and coming through. And then I think the next one was in Salt Lake City, right? But he gets all finishes. It felt like this huge year of escalation for him, where he went from like a star to a superstar, and he was doing it in the most magnificent fashion. If you look at it from the magnitude standpoint of that, you'd be like, okay, that's still the biggest year probably we've seen from a champion. But if you're looking at it, and the other thing with Merab is, I think this is only the second. He's had two. Where he, this will be the second one where he is not the main event. Well, what is that? What's going on?
I love it.
How did I do that? I want to do that again.
I don't know. You're the only one who can do these magical things.
Wow, that's for you guys.
Chuck should not have that power.
this is only the second time. So he'll have two fights where he's the main event and two where he's not. Like, so it, just to give you the magnitude, right? Like, if you kind of balance those out, like, where the magnitude on these, he's not really that kind of draw. So it feels a little less, even though his accomplishment is probably more.
Yeah, I think some of that, too, don't you think, is just that for so long, the light heavyweight division has been the glamour division for the UFC. That's been the one that gets the most attention, brings in the most viewers. So when you have a light heavyweight champ who's putting people away, has an exciting fighting style that everybody, whether you're a hardcore or a casual, can understand and appreciate. And like you said, Chuck, there was that narrative of him basically stepping up to help out the UFC when they needed something. They needed somebody to show up on these fight cards and bring a little bit of star power, and he was doing that for them over and over again.
And it even goes backwards to the Madison Square Garden card, remember, because he stepped in for Jon Jones and Miocic were supposed to be on that original card. So he kind of did it three times in a row if you kind of go back. That's why it felt like such an escalation at the time.
Yeah, I think one of the differences is that when you really look at it, Merab is fighting over and over again, just saying, hey, bring me the whoever you think is the toughest in the division right now. Is it Umar? Is it Petr Yan who's making the comeback? Is it Sean O'Malley? Like, just give him whoever, and he's going to go out there and do Merab stuff. And this is the thing. I remember years before Merab was thought of as a top title contender, and he was in Australia, and I was talking to Ray Longo, and those guys, Ray Longo and Matt Serra, were telling me, hey, Merab is going to be our next guy. Merab is coming up. And Ray Longo said he was the easiest guy in the world when it came to game planning for opponents. He was like, he's just going to go out there and do his stuff, man. Like, you don't have to come up with a game plan for Merab that's tailored to any one opponent. He's going to do the same thing he does every time and dare them to stop it. And so far, nobody's been able to do it.
I asked him about that, by the way. I said, do you even bother to game plan in this piece I just wrote? And he's like, I mean, but he kind of treated it like a frivolous thing, right? Like, it's not a real thing. He's like, kind of with, like, Jose Aldo, you know, and, oh, the O'Malley first fight. I kind of had a, you know, but it was like that. It was. He's like, otherwise, I just, you know, I'm going to do what I'm going to do.
It's interesting, lads. The two most recent three title defenses, Usman and Poatan, they lost their next fight after that. Poatan lost to Ankalaev. Usman lost to Leon Edwards. Ben was bringing up the point of, you know, you are redlining your body at this stage if you are cutting weight four times for a title fight. This guy seems very comfortable doing that. But I did think it was very interesting listening to Sean O'Malley, who's a huge, you know, Merab lover at this stage, despite him crushing his dreams twice. You know, a big fan of his work. He made a good point that we are seeing Merab strike a lot more in these fights. It's getting good to him. His hands, you know, we saw him nearly stop Sandhagen in the second round recently. There is a fear that this is the last fucking guy you want to stand in the pocket with at bantamweight, Pyotr Yan, a guy who has concussive power in his hands all the way back from his ACB days. Granted, we haven't seen a lot of it recently. But Ben, do you have that kind of fear here? Like, you're the one who kind of highlighted this four weight cuts in 1 year to 135. Is this a sleeper kind of dangerous fight for Merab?
You know, I think that it's dangerous on a few different levels, just because I think that When Pyotr Yan's on his game, he's a tough guy. He throws a lot of different stuff at people and has a lot of, like, kind of tricky entries, and he's good at being able to assert his kind of style of fight in a way that you don't totally see it coming until it's too late. The thing is, can he get on offense against Merab? That's a tough thing to do. Merab really seizes the initiative. And as Jack Dempsey's coach and trainer used to say about him, it ain't like football, because he never gives you the ball. He's always just right on offense. He's always coming at you. He's always forcing you to deal with what he's doing. I think that's the tough part for anybody against Merab. And it's going to be the tough part for Pyotr Yan, especially because it's like, when he can get going, when he can get coming forward, using his throws, using his tricky little entries and everything like that, he gives people a lot of problems. But he just wasn't able really to do that against Merab. And, you know, he's put together a good win streak, but if you look at the people he's beaten, nobody's like Merab remotely of those people, you know. And you could argue there's nobody like Merab in the UFC, but especially the people he's fought recently and has looked really good against, nobody has anything like the Merab style. And so it's hard to say you've seen anything from him that makes you think that this fight would go differently, unless you put a lot of stock in him saying, you know, I was basically fighting with one good hand last time, or you put a lot of stock in Merab maybe draining himself too much with this year and all the weight cuts and all the fights.
I asked Merab, you know, does he think that this version of Yan is more dangerous? And he's like, and I was like, what has he done? He's got a couple takedown tricks. He goes, you know, he beat Marcus McGee and he beat Davison Figueiredo. And he kind of goes down the list. And this is how he answers the question. He's like, he deserves to be here, you know? I'm like, that's not what I asked you. I'm like, I asked you, like, what is it? So I don't think he believes that there's anything that's new in terms of what he brings as a threat. And you remember, wasn't it like a record 49 submission, or not submission, takedown 49 attempts? Like, he tried to take him down, like, just constantly in that fight. I think he got 11 of them, and it was almost 7 minutes of cage time, like control time, where he was basically doing what Merab does. I just think that he believes he can do that again, you know? I think that he's like, he won't be able to stop my onslaught. And that it's like, it's up to everybody. When you have a guy who's a big puncher, there's always that factor, right, where you're like, well, if he catches him, if he's able to hurt him at some point, then it probably changes things. But if he's not able to do that, it's hard to imagine that he's, like, developed a defense that's going to prevent Merab from winning that fight over the course of 25 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, especially if you look at recent fights, if anybody seems to have gotten better in some key aspects of the game since then, I'd argue it's Merab. He's gotten more comfortable with his striking, and he's gotten more opportunistic about going for submissions.
I've never seen someone weaponize takedown attempts. That's not takedowns. Takedown attempts like Merab does.
That's a good point.
It's all part of this scramble he puts guys in. Like, it's like, I have to defend it, because if I don't, I'm going to get taken down. But fucking defending, it's exhausting. And somehow this guy isn't getting tired from takedown attempts that fail. You know, like, you look at it, especially in the heavier weight classes, right? We have seen guys fall apart from one stuffed takedown at the start of a round. Later in the fight, third round, Rodolfo Vieira, sorry, that's Reggie just weighing in there, if you can hear that in the background. But you see guys who, they get stuffed, and suddenly it's like all of the gas has left them. Whereas this guy is just constantly doing it for 25 minutes. I've never seen anything like it. So one of you guys take over there so I can mute and let the dog do his thing here.
I was just going to say that, you know, talking to Corey Sandhagen, there was a, you know, it's basically, he's kind of echoing what we're talking about. He's like, well, I'm going to have to like be offensive here. I have to figure out how to land offense on this guy. I think he was more looking like, when the inevitable is happening, when it starts to get into a scramble, I need to do something within that to kind of leave my mark. I got to reverse something. I've got to land something within this. And we saw the fight. I think he tried. It's just easier said than done. I think when you're in there with him and you can see it's just this constant tumult, like you're just trying to stay upright. A lot of times you have both of your arms just trying to try to stay off of the canvas. It's just, he puts you in such vulnerable positions so often that it's very, very difficult to get offense off on him.
Yeah, because especially like anytime you're spending the entire fight just trying to not have something bad happen to you, there's just not that many opportunities for you to do anything. And I think the thing that makes Merab different than a lot of takedown first kind of fighters is that you go out there and you tell yourself, I got to shut down some of these takedowns. Like, I'm probably going to get taken down. I got to get back up, but I've got to stop some takedowns. And he goes in there kind of thinking like, sure, you're going to stop some takedowns, but we're going to be playing that game for as long as right. I want us to do it. And he's not particularly concerned if you do get up. He thinks, you're going to wear yourself out getting up and getting taken back down, sometimes immediately, more than I'm going to wear myself out. And that's got to be psychologically difficult, I've always said, about fighting Merab, is that there can be no genuine hope that he's going to slow down or that he's going to get tired.
When you were like growing up, like, didn't you, like, you'd be a bigger kid or whatever, and you'd be like roughhousing with them, and they'd just constantly keep trying to wrestle you to, like, and then you're like, it's so exhausting to not get wrestled to the ground, or like to, you know, to just keep standing up or to keep getting away from that. Like, imagine 49 times in the course of 25 minutes, like putting up with that.
I also think it's mentally exhausting. George St. Pierre used to talk about this, that the person who is more likely to get tired in the fight is not necessarily the person who's in worse cardiovascular condition. It's the person who is being forced to do something they don't want to do. It's the person who's been forced into the other person's kind of fight. That if you feel like you're always dancing to the tune that this guy is playing, you never get to decide what the pace looks like, where we're fighting, how the fight's unfolding. You don't get a say in that at all. You're just playing catch up the entire time. You're going to get exhausted physically and mentally. And that, I think, is as much as anything, how Merab wears people out.
Lads, I've got to ask, I think consensus, everyone is seeing Merab as the fighter of the year at this stage. Like, if he does this, especially, it's just a cherry on top. Do you guys have anyone close, like, that you think is in a debate with Merab right now for a fighter of the year?
Who would you put in there? I mean, off the top of my head, I can't think of anybody. Do you have somebody?
Islam, because he's stepped up a weight class. Maybe Ilya, he's only fought once because he stepped up a weight class. But nobody based on,
I don't think it matches what Merab's doing.
No, I don't. Ben?
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to beat a guy who sets a new record like this just for sheer activity in one year. You know, like, this is kind of the thing that is unthinkable. Even booking this many title fights in a year, it seemed unthinkable, much less winning them all, you know? It's hard for me to choose anybody over him.
And even, like, the UFC genuinely, like, they don't want to facilitate this many title fights for guys every year. Like, you always hear the likes of Aspinall before, obviously, the eye poke situation unraveled, but he was like, I'd love to fight four times a year. You're like, you're not going to, mate. Like, that there's no way that the UFC are going to lay it out that you fight four times in a year. It's just they have to space them out, you know, put the belts on for marketing purposes for different cards. So it's unbelievable in that sense, too. Another guy who was venturing to do great things is Pantoja. And, you know, it's like the Usman thing. With GSP at this stage, isn't it? Like, it's this constant thing where every time he fights, we're suddenly going,
it is
how
like
close
now.
Is he to DJ? But I mean, How close do you have him, Chuck, to DJ at this stage?
It's tough for me, man, because I think we pointed this out in our round table. Demetrius was there for so long. Now, you could make the argument like he wasn't fighting the caliber of fighters, right? Of like maybe with Pantoja, but he was there for so long. And I always think, like what Ben's alluded to, so like you have to guard against complacency at some point too. Like you got to guard against just, you know, thinking that you're the man over the course of that time. He was always able to just keep meeting the challenges pretty much the whole way through. Pantoja, obviously, is I love him. The reason I love Pantoja and the reason you start to give him a little bit more of a, I don't know, some kind of special glance is because he has no self-preservation. Like, he's not trying to preserve that. He goes in there with the same mentality, which is to wreck the guy coming for his belt. He goes in there to wreck a guy. And I think that you do not see many champions, especially as they kind of get deep into it, where they've had a few defenses, and now you get into kind of more of a historic accord, like people are talking about you a little bit differently, fight that way. But he continues to fight that way. So if nothing else, he's the most admirable in that sense, because he goes out there with the same sense of hunger that he's always had, or that he's the guy coming for it, which is completely bizarre when you're the guy who's the bullseye at that point.
Ben, where do you have him in the old flyweight greatest of all time?
It's tough to beat Demetrius Johnson for me. Still, I mean, I'm not saying Pantoja can't get there, but I do think that in terms of just like all around technical mastery, Demetrius Johnson is still one of the best fighters we've ever seen. As just an all around, like you, when you're trying to game plan for a guy like that, you're looking at it on paper. That's the kind of guy that makes you come away and go like, well, shit, maybe one of the lights from the overhead truss will fall and hit him on the head. You know, like that's kind of the best chance. You got to slip on a banana peel or something, because what else can you do to the guy? And Pantoja, like Chuck said, he brings an excitement in how aggressive he is, especially how aggressive he is trying to take guys back and look for that rear naked choke finish. That also creates some opportunities. So when you look at him, you at least go, it's possible. I can see how somebody could turn his aggression against him. Makes him a little bit more exciting to watch in the sense both that he's going out there, seems like he is hell-bent on a finish in a lot of these fights, but also the fact that he always seems like, you know, he could wobble on the tightrope a little bit. He might fall off one of these times. It creates a little more interest than here goes Demetrius Johnson. He's just going to go out here and dominate again, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe this is just the old school head in me, but I still, when I think back to Demetrius Johnson, made this division, you know, he basically created it. It is the house that DJ built. You got to go a long way to top that.
Demetrius always struck me too as like a guy, because he's a gamer in real life, he loves gaming and all this, but he always struck me as he was seeing himself as a, like, that he's controlling himself with a you know what, it's like, and then afterwards he'd be like, yeah, I caught him with the flying, whatever, you know. It's like he would tell you something like that, and it would just be like it was watching himself from afar. It's such a weird, he had such a weird run. I just felt like it at that time in the UFC, and the, you know, if he was as outspoken as it is now, then, and if social media was kind of what it is now, then it would have been a whole different story for that guy.
Yeah, I mean, he was inventing new submissions, but also ones that, you know, it wasn't like the Von Flute choke where it kind of enters the general usage.
Right.
Because nobody else could physically do it. Like, it's fine for him to do this kind of stuff, but it's not going to become a common submission, because who else can throw a guy up in the air and then get into an armbar before he lands? Like, it's just not something that most people are physically capable of. But you're right. He also seemed like just so mentally strong. I always think about that fight he had with John Dodson, where Dodson kicked him in the groin. Herb Dean went to step in and pause it, and Demetrius is like, nope, get out of the way. And then you can hear him say to Dodson right after that, no breaks. Like,
wow.
If you were hoping that kicking me in the balls would at least get you a moment breather, you were wrong, because I am not going to give you even that space. And you could see it Dodson mentally.
Yeah, going for the old Derek Lewis, kick him in the balls, poke him in the eye, whatever you have to do to get a break. Amazing. Lads, it seems like, and I have to say seems like, because, you know, he retired before and we had a bit of a, well, maybe I'll be back, and Triple C, Henry Cejudo, he's doing it again. He looked fairly rough on the scales there. Jordan said it to me as we were coming on, I went to have a look. It's a tough old cut. As you get later in life, it gets harder again. He is fighting Peyton Talbot. And, you know, Chuck, in the round table, you were kind of mentioning, like, this is like the old wrestling, the pro wrestling rub, you know?
Yeah. Put him on the ice floor. Give him a kick.
Yeah, putting the guy over. But I don't know. It's am I crazy to think that we don't give Cejudo enough respect in some ways? And because this cringeworthy kind of character thing came to the forefront, we kind of pushed away these amazing accomplishments that not so many people have, right? Islam Makhachev became the 11th person to be a double champion. Of course, we have the Olympic gold medal on top of that. Do you have that feeling at all with Cejudo, or is this just me?
Yeah, it never felt like he got. I mean, and also, they played up his credentials, you know, the Olympic credentials quite a bit. And that is something that with other athletes we've seen where it becomes such a bigger deal to their story. I thought it was always a big deal to his story, but it never seemed like he got the kind of, I don't know what it is. Like, it never seemed like he got the credit. Because if other guys, if there's a guy like we mentioned, maybe in the 205 division who had these credentials and had done that, we'd really be talking about this guy in a bigger way. But he never really got there in my mind. And I do think it's in part because he was the cringe guy, right? Like he was doing videos, he was doing all this stuff, and there was just this active kind of like, nah, I don't even want to acknowledge this guy. I don't even want to like talk about this guy. But it's hard to take away from what he was able to accomplish, man. I mean, the division itself, you know, the flyweight division may not exist if he doesn't have that moment. If he doesn't go through and win it, like they were trying to phase it out. And if you kind of look at like some people kind of owe him a debt for some of that type of thing. If you go back and kind of look at it, he should mean more to it. I don't even feel like the UFC has really gave him the kind of shine that he probably should have gotten over the course of time. But I always felt like he'd come back. This feels like the strangest terms for him. Because how old is he now? He's like, he's in his 40s, right? Like 40-something, low 40s.
Wow. I thought he was late 30s. Maybe I'm wrong. Let me.
It's 38.
He's 38. Okay. But still, okay. So, but I thought he'd be coming back way earlier than this. He's 47. But like but he's going against this young kid, and I guess that's the glaring aspect of it, right? Is like you get this guy in the round table. We were talking about this. I'm like, this is kind of one of those ones. If you're gonna make Peyton Talbot, if you're gonna kind of put him into a space right away, have him go through a guy who has some juice on that level, at least as a double champ, you know, and all the things that he's done, you know, you're gonna give him automatic juice. My bigger concern for Peyton Talbot is now what are you going to do? Because if you get by an old guy and you're just able to do it because the dude's old, you're going to be now going against monsters. And we saw it 1 year ago, not even 1 year ago, you know, Barcelos put him on his back continuously and just kind of showed him that there was a long way to go. So it's kind of a weird, like if you win and you go into that kind of stratosphere of really good fighters, I'm not sure Peyton's ready for that yet.
Yeah, that's what I wondered too, especially when I saw the odds on this one and I went, all right, I see why people look at it and they go, this is, you know, old lion versus young lion. We know how this usually goes in fight sports. And it also seems like mentally and otherwise, Cejudo has felt like his heart wasn't totally in it lately. You know, I remember talking to him before the Song Yadong fight. He seemed way more interested in talking to me about various real estate ventures he had lined up than he was in talking about this fight. And it's like, man, I understand it. You know, you get to that age, you're 38, you're looking to what's going to be your future, and it's probably not going to be professional fighting. But if you get to that point where the thing that gets you really fired up is the duplexes you have about to come on the market, and you're fighting these guys where they're 20-something years old and their heart's on fire for this, and it's the only thing that they live for, that's when you should get out. And I think that, if anything, I think that Song Yadong fight should have showed him that in a couple of ways, because you go in there against this young guy he's hungrier than you are. He wants it more than you do. And then you also get poked in the eye and are reminded, oh yeah, bad stuff can happen to you in this sport. Not just like that you won't be physically up for it and you might get beat up in a way that gives you lasting health problems, but weird stuff can happen. A finger goes in your eye and your eye doesn't work right, you know? And if you are not all the way in this, then you probably shouldn't be in it at all. Now for Peyton Talbot though, I also thought about that Barcelos fight, because that showed a huge weakness, and it just happens to be one of Henry's strengths. And so you think if Henry goes in there and is able to fight smart and able to exploit that, how much could Peyton Talbot have closed that gap since then, you know, like almost a year ago? It's wrestling is one of those gaps that's, I think, the hardest to close in a short amount of time. So I will be curious to see how that aspect of it plays out. But as for the question about if Henry ever got the credit, I think that history will maybe be kinder to him than we are in the moment. I think this comeback, the whole comeback thing did not help him legacy-wise because he just, it has seemed uninspired. He just seems like that it was always a mistake. If he had walked away on top and stayed away, I think that in retrospect, we would have been like, damn, that guy really was one of the best combat sports athletes of all time. Won an Olympic gold medal, won UFC titles in two divisions, beat some goats in Demetrius Johnson and Dominic Cruz. You know, got to give that guy his respect. When he came back and was just kind of a shadow of himself during this comeback, that hurt the perception a little bit. But I feel as time goes on, people forget the lows and they remember the highs. You know, so give it time and maybe he'll get that respect.
Unless he keeps being cringy all over his podcast and stuff like that, then he may never.
Well, he's going to do that.
It's the interesting thing about the Barcelos thing. Two-time South American wrestling champion. Not quite the same resume as Olympic gold medalist Henry Cejudo. You just imagine if he can get in those hips, it's a nightmare. Look, we don't see him do that as much as he used to. Sometimes we'd see him put on the singlet there and it was a sight to behold. Like, honestly, he's absolutely unbelievable. But the body does not want you wrestling at 38. I can assure you that. The knees, the back, everything's going, no! When you get down, you're trying to explode in. But I agree with Ben.
And you said he's tall. Like, you in the round table, you're like, he's a tall striker.
Yeah.
So, Henry Cejudo, if he's not going to do that, that's a bad recipe.
That's bad,
you know what
IQ.
I mean?
That is bad IQ if you're not trying to get on this kid's hips.
Yes.
Like, that height, you know, being shorter as a wrestler is actually an advantage. You've shorter distance to the hips, but of course Peyton's gonna love punching down on him. It's a brilliant matchup. I'm really looking forward to it. We should speak about Joshua Van because he's in another kind of situation here against the Elder Statesman and Pantoja, who's looking better than ever. I do feel, Ben, that it's just a bit too soon for Josh Van coming in against Pants in the shape that he's been in lately.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a good fight. It's the right fight to make at this time, and it's an exciting matchup. And I think that, you know, there's probably no way you don't get a fun fight out of this pairing. But it is, you know, being a fighter that young, you could see it on the scales. You mentioned it, PC. Like, you see everybody get up there, all these like grizzled veterans of the sport,
Woo!
And then Joshua Van. Yeah, he's excited to be here, man. This is all still kind of new, and a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of youthful vigor, but. You're going up there against a version of Pantoja who's kind of at the top of his game right now. It's a tough ask. You know, I'll be impressed, you know, and we've seen some guys have, like, you know, we saw Steve Ursag have a surprising degree of success against Pantoja. So, like, it can happen.
He was definitely rushed into his title shot.
Yeah, and it didn't benefit him very much in the long term. But we'll see how it plays out for Joshua Van.
You know what I love, though, about him, man, is, like, because he fought Brandon Royval on, like, what was it? It was, like, a few weeks' notice because he just had fought. And so, like, he kind of sprang into this moment where he's like, okay, now I'm going to go for the champ. It's probably too much too soon. But I do look at that Royval fight, and you're like, man, this was a dude who had such a chip on his shoulder, Royval. Like, everybody thinks he's going to go through me. I'm willing to die before I'd lose to this kid, right? And he goes in there, and so he tries to kill him. But it's like one of those things that it went back and forth. It was a beautiful fight. That's got to still be up there as one of the fights of the year. Just the back and forth of what they went through. But if it showed you anything, it was also that Van's resolve was way higher than we understood. You know what I mean? Like, for a kid that age, like, he was not going to lose either. It was like, I love that sort of thing when neither guy will give an inch and they just kind of stand in there and they both have moments again and again and again. And you're like, how are they doing this? You know, as the fight goes on. If you think about that and the thing we said earlier, you know, about Pantoja just kind of throwing caution in the wind and just being a savage in there, that's a recipe for a very good fight.
Yeah. And I absolutely agree. It's just reckless abandon of youthfulness in there. Like, when you're just like, I don't fucking care. You know, I'm here.
Yeah.
These guys don't really look at it like, well, where am I going to be in 10 years' time? It's like, right now, I have this opportunity.
Exactly.
You know,
nobody's thinking about how it's going to feel in the morning, you know?
Yeah, exactly. We had a congressional hearing yesterday regarding the Ali Revival Act. We've seen a full PR offensive, to be fair, from the UFC. I'm seeing Nick Khan all over the gaff. There's not a podcast that is parallel with the UFC that he did not appear on this week. And he is a very good salesman. He is talking about all the abuses of boxing, which there are many. There is absolutely no doubt about that. We also had Lawrence Epstein at this congressional hearing speaking about the wonders that this revival act will bring through, and Andy Foster, who has been speaking a lot about the great things that this will bring through. It was good to see Ilhan Oman pushing one back towards Epstein, though, which I felt was brilliant questions considering the class action suits that the UFC are still parsing through at the moment and the questions that remain about the discovery documents in those cases. I believe we have a clip of this here.
What minimum share of event revenues can you commit today that boxers could receive under SUFA Boxing League?
Yeah, first let me just address, you know, sort of the lawsuit, which is part of your question. We did settle the lawsuit. It was 10 years of litigation. We made a business decision to settle it. But I want to be clear, there was no finding of any liability or anything along those lines. As far as committing to any percentage today, obviously can't do that. You know, we're starting a new business. If this legislation is passed, we're going to be starting a new business. And it's going to be
okay,
a startup.
Okay, well,
business.
Then let me ask you this. UFC is being sued again, not only with more claims of wage suppression, but also new allegations of... you possibly withholding a substantial amount of evidence that was crucial to the UFC's bid for force their antitrust claims into arbitration. With all these lawsuits, I'm having a hard time seeing why any of the fighters would ever be able to trust that they'll be paid fairly in the system. So, Mr. Epstein, what would you tell the many boxers who are worried about being trapped in a long course of contract, or how will you make sure that the economic freedom of boxers will not be taken away under this model that you're advocating for?
What I would tell them is they're going to have a choice. What's very clear from this legislation is that the existing Ali Act is not going to change at all. We're adding new provisions that will add for, we've talked about, the Unified Boxing Organizations, or UBOs. There's going to be a choice for athletes to make. I don't see how choice is a bad thing. If our system is not providing the economic opportunities for athletes, they can avail themselves to the existing system. But the problem we've got is the current state of boxing is just a disaster.
I got to say, it's pretty refreshing seeing this kind of stuff being scrutinized, because I had a feeling the way people were talking about this, that due to the UFC's many and strong political relationships, that this would just go straight through the Congress, straight through the Senate, and then it would be there. If nothing else, it is good to see people like Ilhan Oman kind of putting this to Epstein, right, Ben?
Yeah, I was very impressed with the specificity of Ilhan Omar's questions on this. Like, she seemed like she had clearly done some homework on it, knew what she was talking about, which anybody who's watched any kind of congressional hearings in the past that involved the UFC or combat sports or anything, it's stunning at times how little they seem to know about the thing that they are supposed to be talking about. And it makes you wonder, is this always how it is in Congress? And I just don't know, because I don't know those other things that they're talking about.
So true. Yeah.
But she really was on top of it and asked the important questions, I thought, you know, especially about like what kind of percentage of the money are the fighters going to get? And hey, didn't you just go to court over this kind of stuff? And aren't you still in court over another matter over this kind of stuff? And maybe it's not going well when you do have to go to court. And it is at this point where we are in America and in the culture at large. Anytime you see all the power players are lining up behind one thing, all the big business interests are lining up behind one thing, it's hard not to feel cynically defeated in advance. Just be like, they always seem to get what they want because they have all the money to spend to push it through. What reason do we have to think that they won't be able to do that here? They seem to have just like built in this prior consent. Like, some of the stages of this seemed like we are just going through the motions as a charade to pretend that there is actual oversight to it. I'll tell you one thing, if all the people making money off of keeping the fighters below 20% revenue share in the UFC, if they're all in favor of doing this in boxing, it's not because they're concerned about the fighters. That should be obvious. I know a lot of people have trouble with this. A lot of people, for some weird reason, when it comes to combat sports, people seem way more willing to line up to back up the owners over the athletes in a way that they don't do in other sports. But come on. You think about it, why they're going to all this trouble. It's not because they're so concerned about boxers. It's not right. Because That's they're exactly so concerned about the state of boxing. It's because they see an opportunity here where they have all the political leverage that they can change the rules to benefit themselves. They can write their own custom legislation to benefit themselves, which is exactly what they've done here.
And you mentioned Khan kind of making the rounds, and you watch somebody like Pat McAfee, who's just like, man, we've needed this for a long time, and like, this is great. What you guys are doing is God's work, and like stuff like
no
that.
No idea
and
what
like,
he's talking about. No, I know.
I'm like, oh my God, it's as bad as what you're saying about like the hearings themselves, where you're like, dude, what is going on? You know, and they're just not the idea that they're getting in Zuffa boxing, getting in to better the sport. You know, and this is their sole mission, is to get in there and make it coherent again, make it better, make the best fight the best. You present this is not what they're doing. This is nothing to do. I mean, it has something maybe to do with it. Maybe they feel like they can improve it, but this is not why they're in the game. Ben, you pointed this out, like they're in the game because they want to steer it in the exact way that they did with their business that she was bringing up in these clips, like the business that they've already had, and that's to make money. And so it's a funny thing to kind of, you know, to know the bottom line of what's happening and to watch it play out. But I will say, I think it was Luke Thomas who was, because he was the one doing kind of blow for blow.
Yeah.
Just saying like, you know, one side seemed like it was very prepared for all of this and the other side didn't seem prepared. And Epstein was on the side that was prepared. They were prepared for whatever they were going to get there.
Yeah. It's just, you know, not that I have these extensive relationships with a lot of people in boxing, but I do know a few people in boxing, boxers, trainers. None of them have said to me, like, this is great. You know, the way these people are talking at the congressional hearing, like, it's where everyone's like, oh, we need this. Oh, my God, boxing needed this so much. Please come. Please come and save this sport. It is absolutely fucked. And everything, like, I can remember speaking to Mick Conlon. An Olympic, he's the first Irish man to win a world championship at amateur level in 2015. He went to the Olympic Games. He famously gave the double birds to the judges when he was robbed against a Russian, which later was proved to be a fixed fight. He is an icon over here. And he was speaking to me about it very early on, like when this was coming out. And he was like, mate, I've never been a world champion at a professional level in boxing, but I earned more money than Francis Ngannou did for any UFC fight when I fought Lee Woods in Nottingham. Like, why would I then go to the UFC knowing that they had the baddest man on the planet and he made less money than I did for contesting a world title fight? And look, there's endless lists of these people. And maybe we'll all be wrong. Maybe this is fantastic. And a UFC-style league is exactly what the sport needed. But, man, there is a lot.
Well, the ones who won't complain about it are going to be the ones, you know, like the guys who, they don't have to participate. The guys who've already made it, they've made tons of money. These people will eventually be pushed out, and very soon, because a lot of them are pretty long in the tooth. A lot of the boxers that we know won't be around. You're really talking about the next fold, right, of the next generation of boxers. This is who it directly affects. This is who guys are going to now have a cap. They don't, and the way it's being presented is, hey, your healthcare is going to be a lot better when you get here. And you know what I mean? It's like you're going to the minimum of pay. You're going to like that a lot better than you would have gotten in minimum pay when you started your career otherwise. I mean, it's all aimed at the new crop.
And that might be, to some extent, a fair argument. The minimum will increase, but it's always been the case in the UFC that it's not the guys making 10 and 10 on the prelims who are underpaid. Those guys might, in fact, be overpaid because the UFC is just using them as card fillers. They are warm bodies until they prove themselves otherwise. They are penny stocks. As Lorenzo Fertitta once described them, and we're waiting to see if they'll pay off. It's the guys at the top who are being underpaid, because those are the guys that are bringing in the viewers, bringing in the eyeballs and the money, and those guys are getting a laughably low share of the revenue. So, and I agree that most of those boxers, maybe they won't even realize the degree to which they're getting screwed, because they won't feel it as, right, I was at this level and I came down here. They will not be aware that I started at this level, and if I had done it 15 years earlier, I would have got here in my earnings, and instead, the power brokers in the sport kind of colluded to stop me from being able to do that. They won't really notice what they've missed, and so maybe they won't feel it as much. The same way, you know, you can tell UFC fighters all you want the way that they're being exploited and taken advantage of, and a lot of them don't get it until it's kind of too late, until they're late in their career.
You have a early contract, six fights, whatever it is, and you're like, okay, it caps out at like 48 and 48, you know. But then the next one, because they were so successful, is like 100 and 100, or like, what? So they think that that's a huge leap right? Like this, it's the conditioning of the way you're brought up. And I feel like if that's what, that's basically what's being put in play here with boxing. And if guys aren't, if you're, if a top boxer in 10 years isn't comparing himself to like Canelo, you know, if he's, instead he's comparing himself to other boxers of his day, it's going to be very different. It's only that those guys exist right now that make tons and tons, like, because that's why we get all over the UFC is because we can compare it to boxing. We can compare it to the old boxing model. Eventually that goes away. This is, it's a long play to take over that sport, because eventually you're not going to compare to Canelo anymore. You're going to be comparing to another guy who's getting, you know, a million or whatever it is. And that's where you feel like, oh, I'm making a million. That's pretty good. You know?
Yeah.
You're right, though, that it doesn't seem like anybody in boxing has been saying, please, our saviors at Zuffa, come over here and fix this stuff. Because boxing, honestly, in so many ways, seems like it's doing better now than it has at any point in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And you it feels like you have more interesting fights, more of the bigger fights seem to happen. I mean, a lot of that might be the oil money propping it up, but it doesn't seem like it's in desperate need of saving. And I also, you know, the ones who I'm surprised have not mounted more of a like cogent and coordinated defense are the other boxing promoters, because these people, they're lining up over here. And it's like there seems to be a complacency from the existing boxing promoters. Those guys are coming to drink your milkshake, man. That's what they are coming to do. And I would be a lot more concerned than you guys seem to be.
They all just hate each other so much they can't join together.
I know. It's true, though.
They don't know how to coordinate this kind of boxing v whatever the hell this is. We should put up our great executive producer, Eric Jackman, had a fantastic post about this from Nick Khan's interview at Zuffa Boxing. What we're looking to do, everything the Ali Act has already said the same. We'll have our own ranking system. The champion will fight the number one contender, just like in the UFC. And there you have it, Eric Jackman. The champion will fight the number one contender, just like in the UFC. And the fights we were speaking about earlier, Gaethje v. Pimblett and Volkanovski v. Lopez, too. Fantastic times. We move on to our finale of the pay-per-view picks. And I believe Drake Riggs cannot be catched. He's gone. He is the king of the pay-per-view picks.
Going to take something
picks.
Special, especially for Ben.
We'll get to this shortly. Before then, we do have some legal updates for Conor McGregor. Two different cases we should highlight. I see a lot of people confusing these two online. The woman who alleged Conor McGregor sexually assaulted her during an NBA game has dropped her lawsuit against the Irish UFC star. The lawsuit claims that McGregor, 37, took the woman by the hand and led her to the men's toilets, where the alleged assault occurred after they met at the courtside club inside Cassia Center. The former two-time UFC champion has consistently refuted the allegations stemming from the Miami Heat basketball match 2.5 years ago. So that one, he was due to answer those charges on December 12th. And been dismissed now. The person who had the allegations against him had revoked them. And as far as the Nikita Han case, we know that the Court of Appeal rejected his appeal in August, and the Supreme Court now have rejected his appeal as well. That is the end of the legal road for Conor McGregor with regard to the Nikita Han case, biggest story in Ireland last year, without a doubt. And that is the end of that one. So two different cases reaching conclusions this week, for Conor McGregor. Now, before
he did find
we go,
God, though, I don't know if you guys have been paying attention to his Twitter.
It's an interesting one. Actually,
the road to salvation.
It seemed like God found Conor because Jesus walked down marble steps and crowned him. Like that would say to me that.
Why is there marble in heaven?
Well, they have taste, Ben. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You been to the Vatican? I mean, a lot of marble there.
Not going
to
be tawdry concrete, I'll tell you that right now.
Coming down steps made of clouds or something. I don't know. Yeah. It does say something about the life you're living, though, when people can get confused about, like, wait, which sexual assault allegation was this against you? Which one was denied? Which one did the court say, no, we think you did that shit? Like, yeah, that tells you something.
I think that's all. I think that's all by the way of SA cases for the now for McGregor. So that's positive.
They save all of this stuff, it seems, for the Friday show, don't they? Like every time these things come down. So next week we'll have something new to talk about with that.
Man, this year this whole year has been finding out something at like 5 p.m. after thinking we're gonna do like a weigh-in. recap. I'm being like, oh no, well, he has been civilly charged for the sexual assault of a woman. Let's do a live show on that one, I guess. So let's hope the God stuff will work out for Connor. I mean, any step towards a better crimeless situation would be good for him, I'd imagine.
You lost interest in what you're saying midway through there.
Yeah,
you
know, pay-per-view picks. Let's go. Let's see that table. Oh my God.
All right.
We can see that Riggs has won it, okay? He has won the goddamn thing. And, you know, I'm pissed off by my own position here. I did embrace Ben Foulkes's strategy at some point.
Yeah.
I've been like, I just need to make some bold calls to try and move up. My goal was the podium. And we can see the podium there. There's a certain hat of gentleman there in third place.
Yeah.
Chuck
Mendenhall. Still up there, but.
You and GC neck and neck for that silver. You cannot get Riggs just based on how the picks have worked out. Mysterious Frank above myself and our fearless editorial leader, Shaheen Al-Shadi. And yeah, Jackman. And then we have Ben down the very end. Ben, you know, how good would it feel to see Peter Carroll at the end? At the end of this week, if I just somehow ended up on that bomb, I think that would make you more happy, you know, than anything else. If it wasn't just, you know, you getting off the bottom, but it was in fact me now on the bottom.
You know, the thing about my picks this week that I want to say is, it's like you're down a goal in the last 2 minutes. Hey, pull the goalie, see what you can do. It doesn't hurt any more to lose by two goals than it does to lose by one goal. You might as well take a swing, see if you can get out of there. I wasn't going to do it by just going straight chalk, by just following everybody else's picks. So I had to make some daring choices that I knew other people were unlikely to make. Is it going to work out for me? I mean, it almost never works out to pull the goalie either, but you got to try it.
You got to try.
You got to give yourself a chance, and that's what I'm doing.
I mean, I appreciate too that you got Blahovic and Guskov as a draw. I mean, that's hard to pick something like that. So good job on that. We'll see.
I'm just looking to see if there's no way that Riggs can be caught. You didn't employ similar tactics, Chuck, where you're like, would Riggs pick?
Why did we overlap on our picks? Because that's why we can't catch him, right? Next year we should have a sixth pick where it's like, you know, there's just a random undercard fight where you can, because then that can be a little bit harder. You know, it's a variable there.
Based on what I've seen from these parlay boys, you know, over on the other show, which we won't name on here, boys.
Yeah.
They'd be going with the minus 3,000. You know, every time that would be in their bonus slot.
Like, no, I mean, it'd have to be a fight. Like you'd pick a fight, like it's a specific fight. You don't just pick any random fight. Like you just one fight that we all have to choose.
Okay.
Like the best fight on the prelim.
The most
right?
even fight. Yeah. Okay. Yes. The most even odds. We
because there's got to be something there where guys like Ben, you know, can still have a little bit of a chance.
Personally, I think that there ought to be an element to this where whoever can do the most push-ups gets an extra couple points at the end of the year.
It's like I'm out.
Yeah, well, I'm last again. Oh my God. Well, look, lads, we are looking forward to seeing how this will all go. There will be the infamous watch along on Saturday with GC and New York Rick. There will be the post fight show with myself and Chuck Mendenhall and the great Ariel Helwani. Ben Foulkes will be doing that usual thing, you know, where he gets the lads over and then he starts busting out a column even though he's 10 beers deep. I think it's fantastic. I wish I had those powers.
So light beers. It didn't even faze me.
Yo, do you know what I was going to ask you guys? What are these light beers I keep hearing being advertised and they sound like something out of Star Trek and they're like, have one of these and they own 95 calories or something. They have a really weird name on them. Do you know what I'm talking about, Jordan?
Are you talking about Michelob Ultras or something?
Yes. What the fuck is that?
Michelob Ultras.
We've had those for a long, long time, man. I don't tell you about those.
I mean,
I remember being in college and having to explain to my roommate's girlfriend that I know you're trying to watch your carbs, but it doesn't really work if you drink 8 of them. You know?
Well, if you're going to drink that as opposed to 8 Guinness, it probably does.
Sure.
That's
true.
Okay. That's fair. Yeah.
Is that the thing about light beers? Like, there's a gap there. There's a culture gap. Here, we don't do the light beers. I mean, is that what it's about? Like, just being able to slam as many as
possible?
Yeah,
I think so. That seems to be the case.
Light beers. The Bud Lights, I was like...
If you're going out there on the lake on a summer day or you're tailgating before a college football game, it's going to get messy if you don't think ahead. You know, have a couple crisp, cool Miller Lights, just enough to have a good time, not enough to go to jail. You know,
we're going to the tightrope battle of nearly going to jail. Is that not what drinking is all about?
Now we're getting into subcultural differences.
I mean, that's the part I enjoy more than anything. Jordan, you're back, and it's been fabulous. I mean, such a seamless return. Probably still intoxicated from the amount of, like, you know, the abuses that man's body's been through for the month that he was in Ibiza. I can only imagine. Yeah,
I heard that if he stayed on a vacation any longer, doctors said they were going to have to come up with a version of Narcan for Mai Tais. That's just what I heard.
There's a lot of rumors going around this New York office about what Jordan got up to, man. It's absolutely insane. But
of course, yes. We know Natty Light.
You'd never know, man. This is seamless shit going on here. Tell me this, Jordan. Do we have any super chats?
Yeah, there it is.
Happy holidays, my wonderful crackers. I like that random crackers. Question. But what do y'all think is next for Robert Whittaker? P.S. Reggie, shut your damn mouth now.
I mean, he said it's not me, out, Reggie. He's calling you out.
I don't hear Carl barking. Carl's a well-behaved dog over there in Montana.
Carl's a nap
such
hours.
A good dog. Joe, you know, Carl, I see Carl like frolicking through the snow, and he just dogs.
Life.
He dogs so well, man. Yeah. And my dog just doesn't know what the fuck he's doing. He's like lying in a full double bed most of the time. Someone feed me, you know? It makes me feel bad, though.
They both got good vibes. I will say that.
Yes, they do. They do. Sorry, what was the question? What's next for Robert Whittaker?
Whenever I hear him talk about going up to 205 or anything like that, that's when I go, please don't. Please don't do that.
It's such a leap, man.
It's a huge leap.
Big. He's not a like small middleweight.
Yeah, he's not a big middleweight to begin with. I don't think that's the answer. I can see how you get into this kind of situation where you kind of go, damn, what am I going to do here other than just fight? Who? Like, they're going to try to slot you into a gatekeeper role, and no fighter wants to be there. I don't know, man. I don't know what is next for him, but I hope that we don't end up getting into a situation where Robert Whittaker is just, you know, fighting just to fight, to keep going to the ballpark and keep getting paid, as they say in Bull Durham. I hope that if we're going to keep fighting at this point, it's to do something meaningful, to have some kind of those fun fights that you see guys get into toward the back end of their career. Because I like him. He's a nice guy. You want to see good things happen for him. But you don't want to see him just going out there and being used as a stepping stone.
I've been given communication from Jordan, and he's clearly drunk because I don't know what this means. It says, tell me if you... Oh, wait, there we go. Six pick idea done from Al Shadi. This is what it meant. You got yourself a deal, mate. I mean, so this guy he can make new rules now? Like, what the fuck is this, Ben?
I carry a certain amount of, gravity when I make the... I do like that though, right? Like we could add, that just adds a dimension to it. It won't be like, if we can't catch Drake, it's because a lot of the fights we're all going to pick the same. I feel like that sixth one will kind of give us a chance here.
It's a great one. It's a great idea. And just to say, me and Al Shadi neck and neck going into this final week. And do we have the exact same picks? The only pick we have differing is him going with Triple C and me going with the Young Blood. You've made a terrible choice, Al Shadi. You are going down, but it was a pleasure dueling with you, sir. I like the idea too. Listen, we'll be back next week. It's not over yet. This is just the final pay-per-view. Chuck might write another column about this. I mean, I haven't seen him this upset in a very long time. It's unbelievable.
So, Ben, that's kind of the job, you know. We got to do it, you know.
Oh, there's my music. Thank you so much, everybody. Have a lovely day. I hope you enjoy the weekend. We'll have lots of shit over the weekend. Come and enjoy it with us. Okay? Goodbye, everyone.